Okay, good morning, everybody. This is BIO 231, and it is December 3rd, December 3, and we're going to finish up urinary system and move on to diversification system today. But first, I just want to go over and make sure everybody knows when that final is. All right, so it's going to be the 15th. All right, so a week from today is the 10th. There's no class the week from today because that's finals week already. So we got two more lectures. We got one today, and then we got one on Monday of next week. But Wednesday of next week, then that's it. That's finals week. And of course, there are no labs during finals week either. So you should be done with lab this week. Maybe some of you, if you have Monday class, maybe next Monday you'll be done. Okay, so that's that. So the final is Monday, December 15th, 10:30, right here. All right, unless you got a problem, then you got to see me with that. Okay, on the board is the picture of a lymph node that I showed you, which is a little bit different than the picture of a lymph node that you have in your textbook. And some people were having a little difficulty labeling it. And this is the one that I'm going to have on the test if I put a lymph node on the test, not necessarily the one that's in your book. So I want to make sure you don't have any confusion with that. So if you have your exam 5 study guide, this figure is there with all the labels blanked out. So if you want to label it with a pencil or something so you can go back and erase it later, that would be good for you to do. All right, so don't forget, lymph is flowing back to the subclavian vein. Lymph is extracellular fluid that comes out of a capillary, and it gets left, doesn't get resorbed by a capillary, so the vascular system that picks up that excess tissue fluid and returns it to the cardiovascular system is called a lymphatic vessel. And as lymph flows back to the cardiovascular system, it has to flow through at least one lymph node to get rid of pathogens. And so here we see a number of afferent lymph vessels bringing lymph to this node. Here are two efferent lymphatic vessels that are going to continue on their way to the subclavian vein. So lymph is flowing through this structure. The external part of this lymph node is what we call the capsule, and that's connective tissue, and there are invaginations into the depth of a lymph node. Right, so these invaginations of the capsule, which is connective tissue, these are what we call trabeculae, and that forms different compartments inside a lymph node. So lymph is just going to flow around through all of these. It's like a maze right here. Right, so that maze is formed by the trabeculae. The parts where lymph flows through are what we call cords or sinuses. And within the cortex over here, there are follicles, and inside follicles, there are germinal centers that are loaded with lymphocytes that can identify pathogens. All right, and as lymph flows through these sinuses and cords, for instance, here is a medullary cord right here before it enters the efferent vessel, these follicles filter lymph and remove pathogens from the lymph before it returns to your circulatory system. Okay, so I think that's all that I'm really interested in showing you here. Okay, so that's interesting that you can label that. If you need to see that again, let me know and I'll put it up maybe before class next time as well. Okay, and so we were talking urinary system. Well, do anybody have any questions about urinary system so far? Don't forget, okay, we drew the nephron out last time. What is the nephron? It's the structural and functional unit of urine formation inside the kidney, right? So one of its jobs is to produce urine. And if you're going to break the nephron down, what are the two major categories of structures would you use to break a nephron down into? They've got vascular elements and tubular elements. Vascular elements contain blood, and the tubular elements contain filtrate or urine. Filtrate is a precursor to urine, and as filtrate moves through the nephron, it gets processed and eventually becomes urine after that processing. Okay, So make sure you can break it down in your mind what the tubular elements are, what the vascular elements. Here are some, these are really nice diagrams that you have in your book, but maybe just a little bit complicated, but the one that I gave you in the study guide is this one right here, right? And so you should be able to duplicate this one. Draw this out a number of times, practice labeling them, and I think we actually drew it on the board last time a couple of times, and so you should probably be able to draw it out and label it in about 60 seconds or so, right? It shouldn't be all that difficult for you. So the first part of the tubular elements of the nephron, okay, would be this structure right here. What's that? That's Bowman's capsule, and then you can check Bowman's capsule. And then the next segment of a tubular element is this thing right here. And what do we call that? That's the proximal convoluted tubule. What kind of fluid is in the proximal convoluted tubule? That's filtrate inside there. Okay, and then the next segment is this right here. It's going to be a loop of Henle, but in particular the descending loop of Henle, and then it comes back up through the ascending loop of Henle, and finally into this twisty, turny, curvy tube right here. That's the DCT. You're right. Distal convoluted tubule. I can't keep up with you guys. Distal convoluted tubule. And finally, filtrate then is pretty much completely processed. So the fluid that we have in this tube right here is now urine, and that tube is called the collecting duct, which then takes urine to the tip of that renal pyramid, which we call a papillae, right? And then from the papillae, where does urine go? Yeah, but there's a number of structures before it gets to the bladder that you should be aware of. What is that big tube at the tip of a renal pyramid called? That's called a calyx, and in particular a minor calyx, all right? Because when a couple minor calyces anastomose or come together, then that forms a major calyx. And then when major calyces come together, it's called the renal pelvis, and then the pelvis empties into the ureter, and then it goes to the bladder. So you should be aware of all those different structures there. All right, and then what is left for us to label on this diagram? The vascular elements. All right, so the arteriole that is bringing blood into the nephron is called the afferent arteriole, and the first capillary bed of the nephron is called the glomerulus, and you should be aware of what kind of capillaries those are. If you know of three different kinds of capillaries, which kind is that in there? Fenestrated. It's fenestrated, which means it's pretty leaky, right? A lot of plasma leaks out, but not large proteins and no cells should leak out if the nephron is healthy. If the nephron is not healthy, then red blood cells and large proteins will end up in the urine, and of course, that's a sign of disease. Okay, so glomerulus, the first capillary. Then this tube leaving is the efferent arteriole, and then the second capillary bed is what we call the peritubular capillaries in many nephrons. Okay, so well, the capillaries around the convoluted tubules are always called peritubular capillaries, but I'm going to show you sometimes these capillaries around the loops of Henle might have a different name depending on exactly what kind of nephron it is. All right, so I'm going to go back and show you that. Okay, so the name of that fluid is filtrate. We talked about all that kind of good stuff. I had another question, but I forgot to mention it. And it has slipped my mind. Okay. Okay, so that's the nephron. And so you can find a bunch of interactive exercises, all right, because you're going to be tested on, blood vessels, too, I think. So there's a labeling exercise for the major vessels in the abdominal aorta, and also in the head, that you can practice labeling this way as well, if you're familiar with using your computer. So here's that list. Arteries of the head, branches off the aorta. I think the heart we're done with already. Yeah, okay. Longitudinal section of the kidney, that might be helpful. And I don't know if you have to know pulmonary volumes in here. I forget if you, did we go over spirometry? I think not, right? Okay. Okay, so that's that website. So I think now we're just going to move on to chapter 23. Okay, so there are two major kinds of nephrons that you have in the kidney. And we see one right here where the loop of Henle hardly dives into the medulla of the kidney whatsoever. Okay, so this is what we call a cortical nephron. And cortical nephrons are important for cleansing blood of many kinds of compounds, and it maybe to some extent can help concentrate urine. But there are times when you are running low on fluids that you really have to concentrate urine to a large degree to preserve fluids in your body, to maintain blood pressure, for instance. And the nephrons that do that job are what we call the juxtamedullary nephron. And the juxtamedullary nephron, you see, still has the renal corpuscle, which is the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule together, in the cortex of the kidney. But look at the loop of Henle. You see that it now goes very deep into the medulla of the kidney. So this is what we call a juxtamedullary nephron, not because that the glomerulus is in the medulla, but this loop of Henle goes deep into the medulla. And filtrate that passes through this loop of Henle is highly concentrated. All right, so this is the nephron that does the job to produce or to preserve fluids in your body, because it produces a very concentrated urine. So the fluids stay in your body instead of losing it in the urine. And the blood vessels or the capillaries that surround this loop of Henle, typically we don't call peritubular capillaries, but we call that the vasa recta. So the job of the vasa recta and the loop of Henle in a juxtamedullary nephron is for concentrating urine. Okay, so when you become dehydrated, these are the nephrons that are doing that job. Okay. Any questions on that nephron? Not too many? All right. I think this is an exam figure, and you should be able to trace blood through the kidney. All right, so blood goes down, of course, the aorta, like the ascending aorta, the arch, and then descending through the thoracic aorta into the abdominal aorta, and then it's going to exit via the renal artery. And then once the renal artery enters through the hilum of the kidney, it bifurcates into segmental artery. So you just have to follow the bifurcations along. All right. And then the segmental arteries bifurcate into lobar arteries and then interlobar arteries. These you find in the columns of the kidney, right between the pyramids. And then the interlobar arteries turn into the arcuate arteries. Those are the arteries that are in the cortex that actually form like arches within the cortex of the kidney. And then there are branches off the arcuate arteries that, here I have them labeled as interlobular. Now, there's a difference between interlobar and interlobular, and it used to be really confusing. And so they changed the terminology of these arteries, and now they call these the cortical radiate arteries, and that's what you have in your textbook. And so that's probably what you should know for the test or for your lab, okay? The cortical arcuate arteries, because where are they located? It's actually kind of nice because it helps you understand where they are. They're in the cortex of the kidney, so it actually simplifies this diagram quite a bit. And then the cortical arcuate arteries feed the afferent arterioles, which is what you're familiar with already. Okay. So one particular question might be, what arteries bring blood to the afferent arterioles? You would want to say, because you know where afferent arterioles are, but maybe you don't know where that other, what the name of, okay, so here we have an afferent arteriole. What's the name of this blood vessel right here?
Cortical.
Yeah, that's the cortical radiate artery, right? And then down over here is the arcuate artery, right? So the arcuate artery feeds blood to the cortical radiates to the afferent arterioles, and then it goes into the glomerulus. Okay, so maybe diagram that one out a couple times too, so that you know what arteries go which next to arteries there. And then the easy thing is once you know the progression of the names of the arteries, then you automatically know the names of the veins as well, because we just keep the same names of veins the same way. All right, so you got afferent arteriole, glomerulus, that's capillary bed number one, efferent arteriole, then the peritubular capillaries or the vasa recta, that's capillary bed number two, And then the cortical radiate vein going through the arcuate veins, interlobar veins, renal vein, then to the inferior vena cava, back to the heart. Okay? Okay, so that is an exam figure, but update your diagram. Well, actually, I erase all of these in the diagram, so just make sure you update it so that you change the interlobular into the cortical radiate arteries and veins. Okay, any questions on that?
The book doesn't have lobar arteries.
Your book doesn't have lobar? I'll have to double check. Okay, I'll have to double check on that.
Is there any nomenclature to help us remember that?
You mean like a mnemonic or something? I don't have one on the tip of my tongue, but medicalmnemonics.com I'm sure has some. Okay, or maybe a good thing is to make one up yourself. All right, or maybe I'll think of something by next time. Okay, because mnemonics sure do make things simpler. All right, especially if you make one up yourself. Okay. All right, so here we have a picture of what? The renal corpuscle with the afferent arteriole and the efferent arteriole coming out and the glomerulus on the inside, right? And then Bowman's capsule right here. So we have filtrate, and this is going to be the proximal convoluted tubule, all right? So that kind of oriented you to the level of magnification that we're looking at. And here we can see some red blood cells within the glomerulus. Okay, so there is an important smooth muscle that adjusts the flow, the amount of blood flow into the glomerulus, and we call these the juxtaglomerular cells right here, or JG cells. So they can contract and regulate blood flow into the glomerulus, but they also have another important function. All right, where are we at? Let me make sure. Yeah, here we are. Okay. So the juxtaglomerular cells are modified precapillary sphincter. They're smooth muscle cells. And they secrete renin into the blood when blood pressure falls. And what renin does, renin is an enzyme that is going to cause the release of a hormone that is going to cause the kidney to retain water and salt. Okay, so it's not quite antidiuretic hormone because that comes from a pituitary gland. But that hormone is called aldosterone, and I'm not going to test you in here, but since you have some interest in knowing some of the names of these hormones, then you're going to have to learn them sooner or later. Aldosterone comes from the adrenal cortex, okay? And so renin eventually causes aldosterone to increase from the adrenal cortex, which then goes back to the kidney, and aldosterone then allows the kidney to resorb more water and salt. So that's going to preserve fluid in your body as well as salt. And when you retain water, what happens to your blood pressure? Okay, it goes up where you maintain blood pressure as opposed to decreasing. Okay, so these cells right here help maintain blood pressure. So the stimulus for this is what? Low blood pressure. So when blood pressure falls, the juxtaglomerular cells secrete renin, which boosts your blood pressure back up, bringing it to normal. So that's the important function of these cells. It helps maintain blood pressure. And you see those cells, okay, you see the cells right here. These are the JG cells, okay. Well, when we look at a nephron, so here we see Bowman's capsule, proximal convoluted tubule, the loop of Henle, and the distal convoluted tubule passes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. So if we take a cross-section of this, here we can see the distal convoluted tubule, and where do we find it? Right between the afferent and efferent arterioles. And these cells, okay, are modified. These cells of the tubule are modified. We call these the macula densa cells of the distal convoluted tubule. And they communicate with the JG cells. All right, so the macula densa cells of the distal convoluted tubule contain chemoreceptors for monitoring decreases in solute concentration or decreased blood volume. So again, when blood volume decreases or when blood becomes very concentrated, that means you are, what, overhydrated or dehydrating? You're dehydrating when your internal environment becomes very salty. When you're dehydrating, your blood pressure is going to have a tendency to drop because you're losing fluids. So the macula densa cells signal the JG cells, or the juxtaglomerular cells, to secrete renin, which boosts your blood pressure back up and helps you retain fluid. That counteracts that increase in salt in your body, right, if you retain water. Okay, so sometimes we call the combination of the macula densa cells and the juxtaglomerular cells the juxtaglomerular apparatus of the kidney. So I think that's something important for you to know, that this area right here, right, is called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. It's the combination of the macula densa cells of the distal convoluted tubule and the JG cells of this modified precapillary sphincter that function to regulate blood pressure. And this is one of the most important mechanisms for regulating blood pressure on a long-term basis, like from day to day, week to week, or month to month. So your kidney helps regulate your blood pressure. And when somebody has hypertension, we believe that there's something wrong with these, with this juxtaglomerular apparatus, or maybe the adrenal cortex, or some mechanism involved with this that is regulating your blood pressure.
So if a person goes in for an ultrasound for a kidney, they check these things, right?
You know, I'm not sure that they can check these things because they're microscopic. You won't be able to see them on an ultrasound. Okay. Yeah, so what we typically would do is look at kidney function using the different proteins that are in the blood. Okay, looking at glomerular filtration rate. All right, so looking at GFR, which is based on various kinds of proteins and how they're being excreted from the kidney, will give us an idea of how these things are functioning. Okay, so ultrasound can't really give us any detail at the level of the nephron unless that pathology is so diffuse. Then we know something's wrong with the nephron.
Okay.
Okay, so the filtration membrane is, where does filtration take place? In the kidney. Remember, I think we talked about three processes that urine, shake your head yes or no. Did we talk about three processes by which the filtrate is processed into urine? There is filtration is one. Number two was the tubular reabsorption. And then number three is tubular secretion. Yeah, I think we talked about all those. Okay, so where does filtration take place again? Between the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule. So just like we talked about the respiratory membrane in the lung, the tissues that oxygen has to traverse from going from air in the alveolus to oxygen or the plasma in your blood or red blood cells being the respiratory membrane. Okay, there is a filtration membrane. And that is, first, the capillary endothelium, which is very leaky because it's filled with fenestrations, which are what? Little windows or holes, like portals within that endothelium. So it's easy for small molecules to leak out. There's a small, very thin basement membrane that attaches the capillary to the, what we call the visceral Bowman's capsule, or visceral glomerular capsule. And that tissue is made up of podocytes. And podocytes just means little cells that have a lot of feet on them, or foot processes. And let's go back and take a look. Okay, that's a pretty good figure, but I think we got a better one someplace. Okay, this is pretty good. All right, so here we see Bowman's capsule, or the glomerular capsule. Oh, let me get the cursor right on it. Right here, that's the glomerular capsule. All right, so you could think of Bowman's capsule as being like a serous membrane almost. What could you tell me about a serous membrane? How many parts does it have? It's got three parts, right? It's got the parietal part way on the outside up against the body cavity. Then it's got some serous fluid. And then it's got the visceral part, which is right on the internal organ. So the Bowman's capsule is arranged pretty much the same way. So the outside layer is analogous to the parietal division of a serous membrane. So we call that the parietal layer of the glomerular capsule. And then you have a space for fluid, which is filtrate in this case. But remember, this is parietal layer is continuous and flows over the capillaries themselves. So this would be like the visceral layer of the glomerular capsule, made of these podocytes. So this is what a podocyte looks like. It has all these little processes sticking off of it, and even these minor processes. But it's not continuous, So these little slits right here are called filtration slits, and that allows for plasma to leak out of the glomerulus very easily as well. Okay, so besides the fenestrations, plasma has to leak out through these filtration slits as well. So these podocytes make up what we call what? The visceral glomerular capsule. But the wall of Bowman's capsule is made up of the parietal cells. Right? So you can you appreciate the analogy between the serous membrane and how this glomerulus or this renal corpuscle is put together? Okay. And what do you got right in this region right here, which we don't show on this diagram? What's in this region right here? What's in this region right here that's helping regulate blood pressure? The distal convoluted tubule comes right here between the afferent and efferent arteriole, right? And then you got some, so you got the macula densa cells of that distal convoluted tubule, but you also have some cells in this afferent arteriole, which are the JG cells, right? So this area right here makes up what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Right, so this is where we find the juxtaglomerular apparatus, which would take us to, okay, this slide right here. Here's that juxtaglomerular apparatus, okay, that helps regulate blood pressure. Okay, so what else do we need to see here? We talked about blood vessels. The urinary bladder itself. Yeah, there's a couple things you might want to know about the urinary bladder. It has that nice transitional epithelium, which is specialized for distension. There is a muscle that makes up the urinary bladder. We call that the detrusor muscle. That's a smooth muscle. You don't really have control over that. At the base of the urinary bladder, there is an internal urethral sphincter. You don't have control over that sphincter as well. All right, but you do have control over the external urethral sphincter. That is skeletal muscle. All right, so when the bladder distends and starts to over-distend, this internal urethral sphincter will dilate and give you the urgency to void, and then at the proper time, then you learn to do this. What age do you learn to do this? Hopefully two, okay. You learn to control that external urethral sphincter for voiding. And pictures of these things are a couple slides ahead. Okay. I think this is it. That's what we got. Okay, so the muscle, the smooth muscle of the urinary bladder is the detrusor muscle. Okay, there we can see that there are folds within the bladder except in the area where the ureters attach to the bladder, here and here, okay, and the urethra. This area doesn't have many folds. And it has a smooth appearance, so we call that the trigon. And at the orifice of the ureters right here, there is not a sphincter. All right, so the job of the sphincter is to act like a valve or a gate to control the passage of urine. But once urine enters the urinary bladder, it is very rare for urine to move back up into the kidney. Even though there's no sphincter right here at the entrance to the ureter, right, it's just that the way that the ureters attach to the urinary bladder, all right, it puts a little kink into the ureter. So, for instance, if my hand was a urinary bladder and my index finger here is a ureter, right, if it attaches in a very straightforward way, then the ureter is always going to be patent. It's always going to be open. But the ureter attaches so that it's bent right there. And when you bend the ureter, what happens? It puts a little kink right in the tube, and so it's kind of rare for urine to go retrograde from the bladder into the ureter, but it can, I suppose, if the bladder is really, really full, okay, because it is possible to get kidney infections if you have a bladder infection. So sometimes material can move retrograde, but it usually does not happen.
That's why it's going to be the whole year urine.
Keep that system working. It's designed to work, right? Don't defeat any of your systems. Your digestive system, when you have an urgency to do something, all right, an autonomically controlled urgency, you should follow that urgency because you'll program yourself to have problems, okay? Urinary tract infections, could be kidney infection, and constipation, for instance. I was talking about the digestive tract, right? So don't ignore that information that you're getting from your body. All right, so the internal urethral sphincter is here, and the external is down over here. So there are two levels of control for voiding. All right, so I think that's it for urinary system. Okay, anybody have any questions on urinary system? Let me just go back and look. Okay, I think that's it. The function of the
podocytes.
Okay, podocytes. They're just the internal layer of Bowman's capsule, and so I think they help anchor the glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule. All right, but they have to be very leaky, so they have a specialized structure, so they don't form a continuous membrane over the glomerulus because that would impede exchange. And don't forget, it's a very special kind of exchange. It's very rapid and allows for a lot of molecules to diffuse through. And actually, not just diffusion, but the proper term is filtration. So filtration works by pressure. So there's pressure inside, there's blood pressure inside the glomerulus that's forcing fluid out. Okay, and so the podocytes help anchor it in there, but don't impede the flow of fluid from the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. Or doesn't impede the production of filtrate is probably the best way of saying that. Yeah. Yeah, which one? Like right here? Okay. So what do we got? Is this an exam figure? It is. Okay. It's different than what's in your book?
Yeah, slightly.
Slightly? Okay, so don't forget the trigon right here, the ureters. External urethral sphincter, internal is here. Okay, yeah, we're going to talk about some of these other things. Okay, so are we done looking at that? Yeah, okay. All right, so let's move on to the diversification system. Yeah. Who? Oh, yeah, okay. Let me see what the kind of picture I can find right here. Okay, so I'm going to go from 23 back up. Yeah, I forgot to mention something that's pretty interesting. 23, 22. What's 22? Yeah, good. Okay. Not bad. Ah, here's a good picture. Okay, so we're looking at the oral cavity right here. So we got the upper airway, we got the trachea, which is part of the lower airway. Yeah, it's a respiratory tract, part of the lower airway. And the larynx is actually the beginning of the lower airway. And because of the structure of the trachea, it's important clinically because what happens to people if they're goofing around? Okay, they can get stuff lodged into their trachea, right, and start choking, and they can't breathe. And of course, breathing is really good. And why is it that why is it so easy to choke? Because there's a certain properties, a certain structure of the trachea and the larynx. The epiglottis keeps you from choking. If it's okay. Okay, but what can you tell me about the structure of the larynx and the trachea that sort of makes it easy to choke if the epiglottis, if you're not controlling that epiglottis just right? Oh yeah, because the larynx is open all the time and the trachea is open all the time. I think I mentioned this in class. So all you have to do is somehow trick this epiglottis not to work correctly and get anything over the glottis, and what's going to happen to it? It's just going to fall right in because the trachea is held open all the time. And why is it held open all the time? Tell me something about the structure, not necessarily the reason, but let's talk because. Yeah, because it has cartilages in there, and cartilage is really good for maintaining a structure or a shape of something. Okay, and the reason why the trachea is held open all the time is because sometimes under heavy breathing or exercise, we have to compress our chest to exhale, and if the trachea wasn't held open, it would also compress the trachea when we exhaled or compressed our chest, and then air couldn't leave our lungs, right? So the larynx and trachea have cartilage, so that helps us breathe on expiration when we have to forcefully exhale. The downside is, since it's held open all the time, junk can fall into it very easily, right? Because gravity never gives up. Gravity is always here working with us. Yeah.
Just like how food needs to be easy to spread when it's tricky to help choking.
Yeah.
Liquids?
Oh, yeah, if you aspirate liquids, that's going to impede the flow right here, but depending on the liquid, it could be very irritating and it could cause a spasm of smooth muscles and things like that. I don't think anybody would choke to death necessarily unless your head is underwater or something. I mean, if you faint and your head falls into a soup bowl or a coffee cup, yeah, you could drown. But typically, particulate matter is much more dangerous to inhale than liquids. But depending on the liquid, you don't want that in your lungs either, especially if it's caustic or very hot, that's going to cause a burn. Okay, so because these airways are held open all the time, they have clinical ramifications on ways that we want to look at people and make sure that their airway is open. But there's another tube that kind of parallels the trachea, and I see it on this diagram right here. What is that tube right posterior to the trachea? And this is what I failed to mention. That is the esophagus. Okay, and so the esophagus is just the part of your digestive tract that helps the transit of food from a bolus of food from the mouth into the stomach, and that does not have cartilage. It just has smooth muscle. So is it held open all the time? No, it's not held open all the time. It's closed. And in lab, when you look at the cats, you can see the trachea is open, the esophagus is closed. That has some important clinical ramifications that are different than the trachea. Since that tube is closed all the time, okay, unless you're swallowing, unless you have a bolus actually going through the esophagus, it's closed. So the anterior wall of the esophagus will approximate, the anterior wall of the esophagus will touch, or what we say, approximate the posterior wall. It will touch all the time, just like the lateral sides are going to touch. So all the sides of the esophagus will touch each other. And what happens sometimes is somebody will damage their esophagus. And maybe even a physician might damage the esophagus, unfortunately. And that's actually kind of a sad situation, because when the esophagus gets damaged, right, it heals. But when people heal, what develops in that site of injury? Scar tissue, right? And scar tissue sometimes is kind of hard to control. And when the esophagus heals and forms scar tissue, since the walls are touching each other, how does that scar tissue like to form? From one side of the esophagus all the way over to the other side. And then it forms a nice, forms just a big clump of scar tissue there, and the esophagus no longer can transit food from your mouth to the stomach. So it heals closed, is what I'm trying to say. So when the esophagus is damaged, it heals shut instead of open, and no one has ever figured out a good way to solve that problem. And so what kinds of people... What are some circumstances where you could get your esophagus damaged? That you could maybe burn it, for instance. For instance, this happens actually quite a lot. Okay. Yeah, maybe for reflux disease. That certainly can cause that situation to develop. But for instance, if you store chemicals around your house, especially things like gasoline that are very toxic, like in the garage, maybe you're working on your car and you have a little leftover gasoline or kerosene and you put it in a bottle, maybe like a Coke bottle or something, okay, and then one of your children goes into the garage and sees an open Coke bottle and they go, oh, hey, look, some soda, and I don't have to ask mom because it's right here. And so they drink it and then they burn their esophagus. All right, that child is going to have difficulty eating and might not be able to eat for the rest of their life, depending on how that situation is treated. Or other kinds of cleaning fluids like bleach or drain cleaner and things like that, which, you know, are laced with compounds to make them kind of smell okay, that a child might actually drink. All right, so usually we're concerned with those kinds of injuries for somebody that's very, very young, having access to those kinds of chemicals. So make sure that you, if you store chemicals in your house, it's properly labeled so that, for instance, if I come over sometime and I see a bottle of Coke, I know that there's Coke in there because I just might drink it too. Right? Make sure you don't have like drain cleaner or something in there. And of course, just make sure all those chemical compounds are away from your kids to where they can't get their hands on them. Right? So even though maybe they can't read, they know what a Coke bottle looks like. right? Because we don't want to have them damage their esophagus. And that's why, depending on what kind of chemical is ingested, sometimes we induce vomiting and sometimes we don't, right? Because if it's really harmful to that individual to vomit, we don't want even more damage to the esophagus. So if you know anybody that's poisoned, make sure you contact a poison control center to find out what you should do. Sometimes it's better just to have that material stay in their stomach until they're treated in the emergency room, okay? And other times it's good to get it out of their system as soon as possible. All right, and that's because why? The esophagus is closed all the time. There's nothing holding it open. Yeah. Well, one of the things when you do surgery on somebody, one of the trade-offs is that you always have scar tissue formation. And people are always trying to figure out different ways of doing surgery and putting special compounds in the surgical site to decrease inflammation and the formation of scar tissue. But that's always a downside of any kind of surgery, is the formation of even more scar tissue. So it's going to be a judgment call. Can a physician go in there and reduce that scar tissue? But when you do surgery, that produces scar tissue. So sometimes you just don't know what you're going to end up with. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of a catch-22. So anytime you try to reduce adhesions with surgery, it's tough, because just by doing surgery, you produce more adhesions. Yeah. So it's not a simple solution. But maybe later this year, which is not much time left, or next year, somebody might magically find a compound that we could squirt in there to prevent the production of these adhesions. But if you prevent scar tissue, you're going to retard the healing process, right? So it's kind of a tough problem to solve that way. Okay. All right. So that's what I wanted to say about the esophagus, okay, because it's closed all the time. Okay, so the diversification system. Let me close some of these windows down here. Okay. I don't think we need this one anymore. Okay. I might need that one. I don't need this one. Don't need that one anymore. Don't need this anymore. Okay. I don't need that anymore. Good. This is going to make life a little bit easier. Okay. Well, right. Let's open up what we want. Let's see. What do we got? We got this right here. Okay. So one of the things that we always like to do when we get to another organ system is to talk about functions as well as anatomy. All right, so let's see. This is chapter 24. Let's go to chapter 24. So let's talk about some of the functions of the reproductive system. And everybody just kind of laughs because they think they know what the function of the reproductive system is. Ah, you're laughing, okay? So who can tell me what the function of the reproductive system is? To reproduce. Yeah, you know, and it's really sort of unfortunate that the reproductive system was named that way, because in my opinion, that's really not the function of the reproductive system. And the reason is the following. When you look around the room, okay, do you see another you in the room? Is there anybody like you? As a matter of fact, not in this room, but if you look anywhere in the world, will you find another you? Not unless you have an identical twin, right? You're never going to find another you anywhere, right? And so the purpose of the reproductive system, we have somebody that's pretty close, pretty similar to each other in the room. Huh? As a matter of fact, it's very powerful, because it does keep the human race alive, right? Because what the reproductive system does is that it produces new and unique individuals. It produces different people all the time. And so it produces diversity. That's the function of the reproductive system. Some animals will reproduce, but they'll reproduce the same organism over and over and over again. For instance, like starfish. Okay, you could cut an arm off a starfish, right, and that other arm will grow into another starfish, but they're going to be identical. They're going to be twins of each other. No genetic diversity whatsoever. All right. Other organisms, for instance, like hydra, which is like a sea anemone, when it's time to reproduce, it's just going to bud a little baby hydra off its side, off of its trunk, and then when that baby hydra gets big enough, it just drops off and it's another free living organism. But that hydra is exactly the same as the parent hydra that it came from. So there's no diversity in that sense. Okay. Well, it's kind of boring, but what happens, for instance, let's think about, you know, there's a flu that's just starting to go around. Is everybody going to come down with that flu? Or a cold, for instance? No. And the reason why is because the human population is diverse, because we're all different, and we're all different because of our reproductive system. Okay, so that's the beauty of what we call sexual reproduction, is that it produces new and unique individuals all the time. So that if there is a disease process that might affect one person, chances are it's not going to affect the whole population. But we gave you a couple examples. One example where there is a disease process that will affect everybody in this room, especially females. What's that disease process called? That's called probably not endometriosis, but that might be... Osteoporosis, right, osteoporosis. So it's really rare to have a disease process that's going to affect everybody in the human population because it is so diverse. And we're going to learn another disease process that affects males, pretty much everybody, okay, if we live long enough. But it's really rare for everybody to come down with the same disease because we are diverse. Okay, so another way of thinking of that is, if you're a woman in here, are you exactly like your mom? No, you're different. And if you have sisters, all your sisters are different from you too. You might be close, okay? Some of you might be pretty close, but you're going to definitely be different because sexual reproduction produces that diversity all the time. And so that's why I call it the diversification system. And that's why that kind of reproduction has evolved in higher forms of life as opposed to asexual reproduction, which just produces the same thing over and over and over again. So to me, it's just kind of plain as the nose on our face as to why, what the function of the reproductive system is not to produce individuals over and over again, but to do what? Produce new and unique individuals, right? So that there is diversity in the population, to handle all kinds of challenges that the population faces, right? So that's the function, because you might be wondering, well, y'all probably know that there's males and females, and they're a lot different, but you probably were wondering, well, why do we have all this complexity? Why is there, like, some people a penis and testes and other people uterus and ovaries? Why is it so complex? Why do we invest so much anatomy and energy into producing these two different kinds of people? Okay? And the answer to that is because we need diversity in the population to make it strong, right? To resist kinds of challenges that might face the human population. So another kind of question I might ask you is, how many genders are there? There's two, right? And is that enough? How come we don't have three genders? And what might be a good way for you to show that two genders work plenty well, that we don't need three genders? Because when you look around someplace, even if you go to, for instance, the Coliseum and watch a football game where there's 100,000 people, are you going to find another you there? Yeah, you're never going to find another you, right? So two genders are plenty to ensure that everybody is new and unique. Another interesting kind of question is it possible for your parents to produce another you? They produced you at one time. Okay, but is it possible for them to produce another you? Okay, well, they could produce two of you at one time, right, if you're twins, but could they produce another twin of you, say, 10 years or 20 years later? And the answer is, yes, it's possible. But because of the way sexual reproduction works, the odds of that happening are just so astronomically high that it probably has never happened. Okay, even if there's life on other planets, it probably has never happened anywhere in the universe. So that's how powerful sexual reproduction is in producing new and unique individuals. All right, so let's look and maybe get a feel for some of how that happens. Okay, and let's start with the male reproductive system first. There's something else too that I always kind of mention right at the beginning. There's a program that started in, I think, Texas, of all places, a really conservative state, and they passed a safe haven law. Does anybody know anything about a safe haven law? Yeah. Okay. And people are becoming more and more familiar with this. And safe haven law just says that if somebody has a baby within and it depends on the state, maybe the county, within 24 or 48 hours, if you don't want that baby or can't take care of the baby, you can surrender that baby to a hospital emergency room or fire station, and there'll be no repercussions. You won't have any legal responsibilities to help raise that child or financial responsibilities. You'll just give that child up for adoption. Okay, because what has happened a lot of times, and I haven't heard of this lately, thank goodness, is a lot of times newborn babies end up in dumpsters and things like that. All right, so this just protects the life of a newborn baby. So if you want to check out this website, and LA County and Orange County has a similar program to where if you want to give up your baby, you can do that within the first couple of days of delivery with no repercussions. Because that can be really stressful on people, mothers and fathers as well, and they kind of lose track of their thinking, and that might cost somebody their lives. So I'm not thinking that maybe somebody in here would do that, but it was a program that just wasn't appreciated that I mention it when we start talking about the reproductive system. So pass that word along. All right, so the male reproductive system. The primary reproductive structure are the testes. All right, and that's responsible for spermatogenesis and hormone secretion. So spermatogenesis is the process of producing sperm, and sperm is a kind of cell that we call a gamete. All right, and females produce gametes too, but they don't produce sperm. They produce a gamete that's called an egg or an oocyte. All right, so in terms of female reproductive system, then they don't undergo spermatogenesis. They would go under what? Oogenesis, the production of an egg. Okay, so that's the job of the testes, to produce sperm and also to secrete certain sex hormones. And in the male, there's only one. We call that testosterone. All right, and testosterone is a hormone that maintains the secondary reproductive structures in the male. The secondary reproductive structures are the scrotum, the epididymis, so a bunch of tubes, the vas deferens, and some accessory glands like the seminal vesicles, the prostate and bulbourethral gland, as well as the external genital, the penis. All right, these are all dependent on testosterone for development. So this right here is an exam figure. So here are the testes, and notice that they are outside the pelvic cavity. Right, they're held within a location which we call the scrotum right here. And what could you tell me about maybe the temperature inside the scrotum compared to body temperature? It's lower, right? If it's outside the body, it's at lower temperature. And the reason why it's outside the body is because spermatogenesis requires a lower than normal body temperature. And so spermatogenesis won't take place properly if the test this is inside the pelvic cavity. And furthermore, if the testis is inside the body cavity at a high temperature, it has a tendency to turn cancerous. All right, so if somebody retains a testes inside the pelvic cavity, it has to be removed. And that's pretty much true for all mammals. So if you raise animals at home like cats or dogs or whatever, as soon as they're born or a week later, you got to palpate the scrotum, make sure that all the testes are descended, because if not, then chances are that animal is going to die rather rapidly of cancer. Yeah. Well, you just touch. You just feel for testes in there, in the scrotum. Okay. Yeah. How does like skeletal muscle, for instance? I don't know if I want to go into the molecular reason for why that happens, but for sure it does. Right. Testosterone supports muscle mass in males. Yeah. It does. Let's see if I can talk about that maybe at the end of the chapter or something. Okay, so that's the primary reproductive structure that secretes testosterone, also produces sperm. All right, sperm then leave the testes and they're stored in a bunch of coiled tubes. In this part of the scrotum, we call this the epididymis. So this is a storage area and a maturation area for sperm. And then when ejaculation takes place, sperm moves out of the epididymis into the vas deferens, moves through the vas deferens now up into the pelvic cavity over the urinary bladder and courses over the top and posteriorly over the urinary bladder, and it passes by a gland which secretes fluids into the ejaculate. We call this the seminal vesicle right here. And the vas deferens then turns into the ejaculatory duct as it's passing through another gland. So here is the second gland. This is the prostate gland. And you can see a couple tubes moving through the prostate gland. The first one is this ejaculatory duct. And the second tube is the urethra moving from the urinary bladder to the outside world right here. All right, so right here, the reproductive tract and the urinary tract unite to form one structure. So this part of the urethra we call the prostatic urethra because it's going through the prostate gland. And the prostate gland secretes other kinds of fluids into the ejaculate besides the seminal vesicle right here. Okay. Now we mentioned, especially in females, that there is a disease process that will happen to everybody. And how rare a circumstance that is because we produce through sexual reproduction. What was that disease process again? Osteoporosis, okay? Well, there's a disease process. Let me go back. How do you protect yourself from osteoporosis? You guys know, you just don't want to say because it's diet and exercise. Okay, diet and exercise. Proper diet of calcium, and when you exercise bones, you make them stronger. Okay, well, I don't want to say it either. Okay, but it is diet and exercise. Okay, that's how you protect yourself from osteoporosis. Now, the disease process in men that all men will have to deal with if they're lucky enough to live old enough, and that is this prostate gland right here gets larger and larger and larger. We call that hypertrophy, prostatic hypertrophy. And when it gets large, guess what it has a tendency to do? Block the prostatic urethra, so voiding becomes very difficult. It might even prevent you from voiding altogether. And, of course, it blocks the ejaculatory duct as well. And prostatic hypertrophy could be due just to that normal process of aging, but it could also be due to cancer that's forming in the prostate. And sometimes it's very difficult to tell if it's a benign process or a cancerous process. But guys in their 80s and 90s will all have problems with this prostate, including the urethra right here. Okay, so the question is, how do you protect yourself from prostatic hypertrophy? Huh? Diet and exercise. Exactly right. Just the same thing as for osteoporosis. But in this case, we have found that what protects you from cancer is a low-fat diet. So that's the kind of diet that people should be on generally to protect themselves from any kind of cancer. And exercise, well, I'm not like saying like lifting weights or anything, but the kind of exercise that the prostate normally does.
Right.
Okay, so that's the kind of exercise that helps prevent that hypertrophy from happening. Okay. All right, so then the ejaculate passes out of the prostate gland, okay, into the membranous urethra. So here is the membranous urethra right through here going through the penis. And there is the last gland, the bulbourethral gland, also adds to the ejaculate. Okay, so that's pretty much the whole reproductive tract for the male. Okay, but we do see the penis right here, and it has cavernous tissues. It has sinus tissues that can fill with blood to produce an erection. And so this is what we call the bulb of the penis. You're going to have to see the crus of the penis a little bit later. This part right here is what we call the ventral penis, and this is the dorsal penis. And here is the glans penis, which is actually part of the ventral penis right here. Okay, so the ventral penis, right, is what we call the corpus spongiosum, and the dorsal penis is the corpus cavernosum. And as a matter of fact, there are two corpora cavernosa, and so you should know the difference between the singular spelling and the plural spelling and pronunciation. Okay, so that's a good exam figure for you to know. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the testes in particular. They're about 5 centimeters in length. There's a capsule, connective tissue capsule on the outside, just like most organs. And the capsule invaginates into the deep into the testes and forms a couple different layers. So let's take a look at some of these layers. Okay, here we go. So here's a nice picture of the testes. So here is the capsule. Okay, and then here is the tunica vaginalis right here. So this is inside, of course, the scrotum. And vagina, what does vagina mean? Vagina just means that it's a coating of something. It's a sheath for something. All right, so that's what vaginalis right here of the testes means. All right, then here is the layer of the tunica albuginea. And then here are the invaginations that form septa, which help divide the testes up into various chambers. Within the chambers, we have seminiferous tubules. And within the seminiferous tubules, that's where spermatogenesis takes place. All right, so these are microscopic tubules that you can't see with your naked eye. And this is a nice cross-section of a seminiferous tubule. There are germ cells that produce sperm, and then there are support cells that support that process. And in the lumen of the seminiferous tubules, that's where we actually find spermatids that have flagella already. What's the function of a flagellum? Okay. Yeah, therefore motility. So these cells are motile and will find their way into the epididymis. So here's the epididymis where they're stored for ejaculation, but they also mature. So seminiferous tubules empty into these, this is what we call a straight tubule right here, or a tubulus rectus, and the tubulus rectus empties into the Reedy's testes, which then feeds into the epididymis. Okay? All right, so that's how sperm end up over there. So germ cells, the support cells are what we call Sertoli cells. And these support spermatogenesis. So it provides nutrients for spermatogenesis so that the spermatocytes don't die. There are cells outside of the seminiferous tubule. So here is a tubule. You can see the basement membrane around it. Here is another tubule. And in between the tubules, right, are other cells that are outside. We call these interstitial cells. And the interstitial cells are important because they secrete testosterone. All right, so testosterone goes from these cells outside the seminiferous tubule to inside to support spermatogenesis. And those sometimes we call sustentacular cells or Leydig cells or interstitial cells. Okay, let's go back to this slide right here. Okay, so here we see a cross-section of the penis and a scrotum, and we can see some things inside the scrotum. We can see the corpora cavernosa and the corpus spongiosum right here. But more importantly, here is the testes inside the scrotum, and you can see the epididymis. But now you can see that there is a cord that connects the pelvic cavity to the testes right here. We call that the spermatic cord. And the spermatic cord has a number of different features, right? It has muscle. Okay, so this muscle right here is what we call the cremaster muscle, right? Which helps suspend the testes. But we also have a testicular artery, a testicular nerve, and a testicular vein. And the testicular vein is, you can see, it forms like a network or a plexus around everything inside the spermatic cord, including the spermatic artery right here. And that has an important function. So this thing right here, this plexus of the testicular vein, is what we call the pampiniform plexus. And this acts like the radiator in your car. Because as blood, arterial blood, is coming down from the pelvic cavity, it's at, what, 98.6 degrees? All right, but what's the whole pump, the whole purpose of having the testes outside the body? To keep them cool, but if they're getting blood that's at 98.6 degrees, that they're going to be too hot. So the pampiniform plexus, right, forms a network around the testicular artery, so heat goes from the artery into the vein, and it takes the heat back into the body instead of heat going to the testes. So the testes indeed are cooler than the pelvic cavity or the rest of the body. Okay, so spermatic cord is made up of what? The cremaster muscle, the pampiniform plexus, the testicular artery, testicular nerve, as well as what is the part of the reproductive system that goes through the spermatic cord? What do we call that? Not the epididymis, because here's the epididymis, but it's also the vas deferens as well. So those are all things that make up the spermatic cord. Where do I have spermatic cord? Maybe someplace. Here. Maybe I don't have it on the slide. Well, you should know. Okay, well, let's talk about the various other glands that add to the ejaculate, like the seminal vesicle. That forms about 60% of the semen volume that produces sperm nutrients, in particular fructose. That's a monosaccharide. And some prostaglandins that stimulate uterine contractility, so that causes the uterus to contract, which help move sperm up toward an egg. It contains motility agents that activate sperm. Immunosuppressants, because when sperm enters a female's body, right, it's a foreign tissue, and the female is going to develop antibodies against that foreign tissue. But of course, if we want the species to persist, there has to be a way to suppress that rejection from the female's body. All right. And also, when sperm is deposited in the female's body, it has to coagulate so it doesn't run out right away. So there are coagulants that are put there in the seminal vesicle. And there are also pigments. There are chemical compounds that absorb and reflect light. And we have no idea why these things are in there. But because those pigments are in there, it's very easy to identify ejaculate. Okay, and that might be found someplace, okay, probably for criminal purposes. Okay, prostate gland forms only about 30% of the semen volume. It contains a neutralizing solution because the pH of the male urethra is acidic, and that will deactivate the motility of the sperm, and the female vagina is also acidic, which will have the same effect on sperm, will decrease motility. So the prostate adds a neutralizing solution. It has motility agents. It has more coagulation agents. And then there's something, okay, after semen coagulates at a later time, it has to liquefy. So there's like a delay reaction taking place. And that is something that we can measure that comes from the prostate gland. We call that prostate-specific antigen. All right, so that will cause liquefaction of the ejaculate later on so that the sperm can be released to fertilize an egg someplace. And the small bulbo urethral gland forms only about 5% of the ejaculate, and it is mostly mucus. Okay, mucus is a protein. Of course, it's slippery, so it acts like a lubricant. But because it's a protein, it also acts like a buffer. It neutralizes acid. So mucus can neutralize acid and protect the sperm motility. Okay. So you saw where all, you can remember where all those were. All right, the urethra has got a couple divisions, a prostatic urethra as it's moving through the prostate, the membranous urethra between the prostate and the penis, and the spongy urethra, or sometimes we call that the penile urethra as it's going through the penis. And then the erectile tissue, the two kinds of erectile tissue, you got the corpora cavernosa in the dorsal penis with the crus in the root of the penis, and the corpus spongiosum, which forms the ventral penis as well as the head of the penis and the bulb. So let's see where we can find those at. Okay. This might be an exam figure because it goes over the corpus spongiosum and corpus cavernosum. Okay, you can see some glands like the seminal vesicles and the prostate gland. I guess I don't see the, oh, here's the bulbo urethral gland right here. Okay, so here is the membranous urethra, here's the prostatic urethra, and here is the penile urethra. And on either side, right here, okay, on either side we see the crus of the penis, and then the bulb of the penis right here. So this is part of the corpus spongiosum, which includes the glans penis, and the corpora cavernosa right here and right here, which helps make up the crus of the penis. All right, so the bulb and the crus just help anchor the penis to the body wall, of course, because... it's vascular tissue and connective tissue, but no cartilage. But some mammals do have probably cartilage, I'm not so sure, but some actually have a bone as well. Okay. But not in humans. Okay. So I think that's all I need to show you on this particular slide. Okay. All right, so we talked about prostate disease and everything in the reproductive tract. Okay, so I think that's it for today. So the last thing that we're going to cover next time is the female reproductive tract. Okay, and let's see. What is today? Wednesday. Yeah, it's Wednesday. Okay, so we have one more lecture left. So that's good. We got plenty of time to answer questions and finish up whatever we need to finish up for the class. Okay. So, oh, you know the final exam right here? Goes to what? 12:30. 10:30 to 12:30. Good, thank you. Is there any SI between now and the end?
Yes, there is. Monday, Wednesday, next Monday, and then Tuesday.
Okay. So it's today?
Today.
So SI today?
Yep.
And Monday? And Tuesday. Cool. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.